Blog Talk Radio.
There's a direct relationship between having the businesses and being in prison. Go find an see how many Asians you can find in American prisons. You ain't gonna be in there. But 51% of your prison will be black because blacks don't have any businesses and industries. There's a direct link. Blacks won't practice group economics. Black won't practice group politics. If you don't practice, you're setting yourself up. And I told that five-story building, you're setting yourself to get wiped out. Understand the nature of race, which is economics. If you build the first floor, it's economic. Build your businesses and your industries. Control business and industry, and put that pulls in your money, and hold that money, and practice group economics with it. Arab and Asian money bounces 12 to 13 times for a lead. Jewish money bounces 18 times. Black folk got to learn how to practice group economics. Black Americans spend every penny they get outside their own community. Then you take the money and the wealth that you get from that first floor and go to the second floor. The second floor is politics. You then take that money on the first floor and you control your politics. Black folk must quit allowing people to tell them to go out and vote. Vote for what? Nobody's going to do anything for black folk in politics. Politics is controlled by money. Major corporations, who got the money? That's what controls politics. If you have no money, you have no say-so, you have no benefits coming. So you take your money and you control, and you take your money on the first floor, you buy every politician on the second floor. And any politician you can't buy, you rent or lease them to get what you need. Then once you get the second floor under control with the politician, with your money, then you go to the third floor. The third floor then is the police department and the court system. You take your money from the first floor and your politics on the second floor, and you control the court system and the police department. Then the fourth floor, that is media. You then take the money that you generate off the first floor from business and industries, and you go after radio stations, TV stations, newspapers, and cable systems so that you can now inform and communicate with your own people. Right now, black folk only control less than 35 thousandths of 1% of the media in the United States. Out of 12,000 radio stations, black folk own about something like about 75 or 80. That's all. You own no cable systems. You don't have a daily newspaper. You have nothing of importance. You got about one black TV station. So you can't communicate with your people. You can't inform your people. You can't do anything. You can have Rush Limbaugh and all the rest of the guys talking about racism all day long and bad-mouthing you. And O'Reilly, they can call black folk all kind of names all day long. What are you going to do? You can't respond. You can't even communicate with your own people because you don't have an economic base. 51% of all the prisons in the United States are black people. You know you only make up 12% of the population. That's no accident. It's because you don't control the economics and the politics. And they're going to go after the weakest people they get their hands on to incarcerate. And that's the black folk. And what are you going to do in response to them when they over-incarcerate you? You're going to go out and have a march, a demonstration. We're going to march. March, well, who cares? Marching, they never changed anything.
Many a young athlete entertains hoop dreams. Few, if any, have tried as hard to make them come true as the kid our Steve Hartman has gone to see.
Every week, he set himself up for disappointment. Every week, 13-year-old Jamarian Stiles came to this community center in Boca Raton, Florida, hoping to play basketball with the other kids. And every week, he was rejected.
They'll start picking teams, and I would be the only one left out. And then they'll just tell me, just go home and stuff. You can break someone's heart like that.
The problem was obvious to everyone but Jamarian. He lost his hands and most of his arms as an infant due to a rare bacterial infection. But he insisted that was no reason to give up his hoop dreams.
What about soccer? Have you heard of that sport?
Yeah, hear it every day.
Why don't you play soccer? That just seems like the obvious thing.
You would think that I would be good at soccer. I'm really not. I'm horrible.
Which is why, on the first day of class here at Eagles Landing Middle School, Jamarian took his case to basketball coach Darian Williams.
Yeah.
Said he wanted to be on the team this year.
I said, all great, well, just make sure you try out.
He said, okay, great, but what are you really thinking?
This man has no arms.
Yeah.
How is he going to play basketball? But man, he told me, Mr. Williams, I've never been on a team before. Even if I don't play, I just want to be on the team. And how could I say no to that?
And that's how the Eagles got their first armless basketball player. Jamarian, number two there, quickly earned a reputation as the hardest worker on the squad.
He was usually the first one in the gym, usually the last one to leave.
Still, he sat on the bench most of the season.
Try one more.
Until last month. Coach put him in the game with about 6 minutes left. And when he eventually got the ball on the far side of the court, everyone yelled, shoot it! So he did. And sank. A three-pointer. And if you didn't quite see that, don't worry. Because shortly after, he got the ball again. This time on the near side. For another three-pointer. At the buzzer. Jamarian Stiles, the kid no one would pick, was now everyone's hero. Needless to say, today, Jamarian can play all he wants at the community center. He just made the volleyball team and has every intention of playing football next year. Really, the only thing he won't play is the victim.
If I could wave a magic wand right now and give you your arms back, would you want them?
I don't need them.
You don't need them?
No.
Who needs hands when you've got this kind of touch?
Now learn this from Joel Osteen. That's my man. He be texting me. That's my man. This God done put some people around me, show me some stuff. He was telling this story. He said, this man that went to heaven, and he was walking with Peter down this aisleway, and it was going down this corridor, had a lot of doors on it, and said all these doors had names on it. And he said, Peter, let me ask you something. What's all these doors, these names on? He said, don't worry about it. Just go ahead. So he kept walking. He messed around. He saw one of them doors and had his name on it. He said, whoa. He said, hey, Peter, this here ain't got my name on it. Something I need to know? He said, man, don't worry about that. You here now. Just go on in there and talk to him. See what he's here. He said, nah, I want to know what's in the door. He said, you sure you want to see what's in the door? He said, yeah. So he opened up the door. It was a warehouse. It had nothing but shelves on it. And then the shelves had nothing but packages. And all the packages had his name on them. And he said, what is all these boxes? He said, that's all of the blessings, all of the things God wanted to ship to you. But number one, you didn't ask him for it. Then number two, you didn't believe you would have it. Then you doubted him. And then you felt like you wasn't worthy. And so now all these boxes is up here. Now the man standing there wishing he had never even been in the room. And I started thinking. I got some dudes that work for me. And I said, I want you to do this graph for me. And that's what I'm finna show you now. See, what you're having is, when God sends your package, he only sends it to one street. That's Faith Street. You got to stay in faith. You can't move off of Faith Street. You can't get on Doubted Drive. You can't be over there and start doubting it, because your package going to go right on by. You can't lose your faith and get on not meant to be way, because your package is going to keep going right on by. Because the package just go to Faith Street. You can get your little feelings hurt, I ain't worthy. Guess what? Your package going to keep going right on by. You have not because you ask not. Then you sit up here and start feeling sorry for yourself. You go on pity way, your package keep going right on by. If you stay right on Faith Street, don't ever come off, because the blessing is coming. If you wait on it, here it comes. It may not come when you want it, but it's on time. But if you get up and you move off of Faith Street, your box gonna get sent back to sender. And now you're gonna have a warehouse with a bunch of boxes with your name on it that you didn't never get. And I don't know about you, but I want everything he got for me. If he got something for me, I need all of mine. Because I don't know about you, but God lay you out, man. God will give you stuff. Man, he done took me places. I ain't never thought I was going to go. I done seen parts of the world I never even thought I could go to. He done gave me stuff. He done put people in my life. God will do it for you, man. But you just got to stay, man. Use these principles of success. Understand, God is just that way. He'll lay you out. Because if he can lay me out, see, if he fix me and change me and get me over here trying to do better, I ain't perfect. I'm just trying to do better. I still say some stuff I ain't supposed to say. You understand? I ain't got it all together yet. I just got in the gate. I'm a new kind of Christian. But ain't no lock on my gate either. So if you see, once you check me, I'm probably going to check you back. But I'm getting better at that. I don't know how to love my enemies yet. I'm getting better at it, though. But it's a process. And the more times we can make people understand that it's a process, the more people can come in. And y'all people that have been good to me, that have been praying for me. I mean, man, my mama, if she could see me now, I just wish my mama could see me. Because she's been praying for this hill all her life. Watch my son. Well, he done watched me, mama. And I'm cool now. And my philosophy is very simple. I was who I was, but I am who I am. And I'm cool with both them people. Because who I was wasn't that bad, Cap. I made some mistakes, but I've been changed a little bit. And it's still a process. And the more people that you invite into the process, the better this is. Because ain't nobody perfect no how. So I really appreciate y'all, man, hearing me and listening to me. I'm going to ask Kirk Franklin if he will come.
Friends, it is time once again for our daily message of hope. And with today's message, here is Richard Eaton.
Friends, to brighten your day, here is our message of hope.
A man who taught many wonderful truths about life once said, "Make the most of your present opportunities. Make the most of your present opportunities." Let me repeat once again. Make the most of your present opportunities. And the longer I live, the more convinced I am this is a wonderful piece of advice. Appreciate the present before it becomes the past. Make the most of your present opportunities. So many of us waste our present time worrying about the past or the future. And actually, we can do nothing about either the past or the future. Little sympathy or patience should be wasted on the person who is eternally crying for the good old days, or bemoaning that things aren't as they used to be. Naturally, they aren't. Time changes all things, as it is changing you right now. And were it not for change, there could be no progress in this world of ours. Probably a good bit of advice to all of us would be to live every moment as it comes to us, just as though it were the only one we had on earth. To appreciate the present before it becomes the past. Let your life be filled now with love, with happiness, with harmony, with courage, with faith. Too many of us are wasting energy trying to relive the past. And we are putting off our good from day to day, from month to month, and from year to year, so that we never quite catch up with it. Why not live now? Forget the troubles of the past and stop dreading the future. The expression of our powers and abilities is governed by our thoughts. If our thoughts are dwelling in the past or in the future, our power and abilities will be lessened in the present because they will be trying to follow our thoughts to realms that do not exist. We need all our abilities right now in the present moment. We cannot afford to dissipate them by letting our mind dwell on the past or by worrying about the future. If we live rightly every present moment, we shall have no occasion to mourn over the past. What does it really matter today, what happened yesterday or some other day in the past? It is beyond our recall, so it is not worth the effort of worrying about it. Dr. Frank Crane expressed a bit of good philosophy on this matter in his short article called The Past. Says Dr. Crane, a good deal of morbid nonsense has been said and written and thought about the past. The past is irrevocable. We have been told in sermon and story, you cannot escape the past. The past can never be changed. And so on and so on. The whole trend of this thought being that the past is a kind of a Sherlock Holmes, dogging our steps forever, a sinister nemesis, waiting its chance to strike us down, the account book of an angry God, sure to confront us someday. All of this is morbid. Most of it is dramatic. The underlying sentiment of it is false and weakening and septic. As a matter of fact, our past, as Maeterlinck puts it so well, depends on our present and changes with it. Our past depends on our present and changes with it. What the past is depends upon the way you are now using it. Its effect upon your destiny will be gauged by how you translate it into the future. If we brood over the past and weaken ourselves with vain regret, with self-contempt and remorse, then that past will poison and undo us in the present. But no matter what the past contains of our sin or folly, we can, by a right use of it now, make it minister to our welfare. First of all, we can learn wisdom from the past. By it, we can realize our faults to be corrected and our offenses to be atoned for. And with this wisdom, we can go on to better things. The only true repentance is so to use the past as to enable us to build a better future. Weeping and wailing and brooding, those are the luxuries of morbidity. The past is beneath our feet. We can go down into it and wallow in impotent grief, or we can step upon that past to higher things. The great enemy of life is despair. The great friend is hope. Despair paralyzes, ruins. Hope energizes, for we are saved by hope. Face the future. Whatever the past has been, let it nerve you to spend your remaining days in faithfulness and loyalty to your better self. These are the words of Dr. Frank Crane, and I feel he certainly has the right view. Be concerned about your past only to the extent that it can teach you. The mistakes and sorrows of yesterday belong to yesterday. Yesterday provided sufficient time in which to consider its woes. Most of the worries, the griefs, the heartaches that we suffer are nothing more or less than memory of the troubles and hurts that we experienced some time in the past. If we could only remember that sufficient unto the day is the evil thereof. Moffat renders this passage as the day's own trouble is quite enough for the day. And when you stop to think of it, isn't this true? We can readily understand from this that the miseries or woes of yesterday can enter today or tomorrow only through our memory. Before the end of yesterday, we should have put out of mind every disturbing thought caused by yesterday's situations. Those were yesterday's problems, so let them, along with yesterday, pass from sight and from memory. Let not the sun go down from your wrath is a mighty good bit of advice, or so it seems to me. We should not let the day close with our mind disturbed. It is too late to do anything about the way we let yesterday close. But we can do something about the way we let today close. Let us set today free in order that we may meet tomorrow, another new day, fresh and clean and unused, in the right spirit. Our wrath, mental disturbance, and physical miseries of yesterday have no place in our today. They only serve to crowd out the joys and blessings that are in store for us today. Each new day, a new world will begin for us if we do not carry into it the woes of yesterday. If we have not forgotten the woes of yesterday, we do not really experience a new day. To us, the day is just an extension of yesterday. When we let yesterday's sun go down, finding us wrathful and disturbed in mind, we are not obeying the biblical injunction to forget our miseries. We are not approaching the new day with a clear mind and a clean heart. The wisely given command to forget is a provision for our happiness. Were we to remember all our mistakes of the past, we should not have time to think of the good we want. Thou shalt forget thy misery. What shall we forget? What does the misery include? What comes under the category of wrath of mind? Everything not founded upon God or good and truth. It was meant that we should enjoy today to the exclusion of the wraths and miseries of yesterday. We are not to let one little rankling thought of yesterday sully the purity and beauty of today. You know, friends, the sleep that God gives us at night is but a form of his power to help us forget. Sleep is a vestibule through which we pass from one day to the next. We are to shed all our useless thoughts before we approach the next day. What of the wrongs that someone had committed against us yesterday or some other day? What of our jealousies and suspicions? What of the things we secretly accuse ourselves of? All these must go. We must forget them. They belong to the dream or nightmare of the past in which we have awakened to a new day. Are you willing to obey the command, "Thou shalt forget thy miseries"? You alone can decide. You alone can reap the benefits of forgetting. You alone can decide whether you will spoil this new day, fresh and clean and unused, by harboring the adverse thoughts of yesterday. You alone can decide whether you will today remain in the wrathful state of mind of yesterday, or whether you will make the most of your present opportunities. The things of yesterday brought to your mind, which cause you to be disturbed, are quite insignificant today. Forget them. Learn to wipe from mind every thought that works against your highest good. Enjoy today to the fullest. You can do this only by approaching it with a clear mind, receptive to the good in store for you. Let each new day begin life anew for you, rather than being merely an extension of yesterday. Start out this morning by obeying the command to forget. Make up your mind you are not going to try to carry yesterday along into this brand new day. Erase from your mind any sense of blame, any memory of failure, all thoughts of wrongs of the past. Was it not Ruskin who said, "Let every dawn of morning be to you as the beginning of life"? and every setting sun be to you as its close. Then let every one of these short lives leave its sure record of some kindly thing done for others, some goodly strength or knowledge gained for yourself. Let me repeat, let every dawn of morning be to you as the beginning of life, and every setting sun be to you as its close. Then let every one of these short lives leave its sure record of some kindly thing done for others, some goodly strength or knowledge gained for yourselves. It behooves all of us to live in the present in the way that will make of our future that which we wish our present were now. Yes, friends, it's up to us. We can go down into and wallow in impotent grief, or we can step upon the past to higher things. It is up to us. And so, friends, you've been listening once again to our message of hope. God bless you, everyone.
Listen again tomorrow, friends, for another message of hope with Richard Easton. This is UBC, the United Broadcasting Company.
In the sky, it is a flame in the summertime. No. Everyday Black History. Now today on Everyday Black History, we're going to be highlighting a man, a brother by the name of William Washington Brown, and he was born October 20th, 1849, and he died December 21st, 1897. Now he was a former slave, Union soldier, and he was the founder of a fraternal organization that he was able to build into a small economic empire called the Grand United Order of True Reformers. He was also a minister, and he was also a teacher. But to give a little background history on him, he was born into slavery as Ben Brown in Georgia on October 20th, 1849, to Joseph Brown and Mariah Brown, both of whom were slaves. But he was sold to a horse trader around the age of 8, and after this sale, he changed his name to William Washington. Now, he escaped his owners during the Civil War and joined the Union Army, where he remained until he was discharged from service in 1862. And after being discharged, he attended school in Wisconsin and began a teaching position in the South, during which time he met and married his wife, Mary A. Graham. Now, he was an outspoken proponent of the temperance movement, which was a movement against the consumption of alcohol, but he was equally outspoken against the Ku Klux Klan. Now, he initially wanted to join the Independent Order of Good Templars, which was another fraternal organization, but he was denied membership because the society was traditionally white. But they did offer him a sponsored charter of his own, which he named the Grand United Order of True Reformers, and he accepted this sponsorship. Now, as mentioned, the Grand United Order of True Reformers started as a temperance organization or a fraternal organization of people of like minds. And in 1876, he branched out and moved to Richmond, Virginia. And when interest in the organization began to decrease, he focused on turning the organization into an insurance organization. Over time, it continued to grow in size, where it began to manage a bank, ran a newspaper entitled The Reformer, owned several properties, and at one point was the largest black fraternal society and black-owned business in the United States. Now, this is all coming from a person who was born into slavery, mind you. Now, during Brown's life, the organization enjoyed much success. However, after later on in his life and toward when he died, it suffered crippling setbacks due to employee embezzlement and businesses defaulting on large unsecured loans, causing its collapse after his death, of course. But while he was alive, the organization was a thriving organization, and it did well. As mentioned, it was one of the biggest black-owned businesses in the United States. He started from being a temperance organization to go to an insurance company, owning banks, several properties, and newspaper, and that's extremely impressive for anyone, let alone someone who was a former slave. Now, as mentioned, he died December 21st, 1897, due to cancer. So, but because of his accomplishments, because of what he accomplished, we highlighting him today for his contribution to black history and the black culture. And William Washington Brown, we thank you for your contribution, and we salute you. Now, that concludes this episode of Everyday Black History. We ask every day, all the time, that you continue to tune in as we have more episodes where we will be highlighting African-Americans, Africans, and even Afro-Latinos, which will be coming soon. But we'll be highlighting all contributions to black history and black culture. So stay tuned.
All right, today's podcast, which was inspired by one of our listeners yesterday, listeners and participators and contributors, and we're going to, on a regular, we're going to be doing black Mount Rushmores, which could be just called Mount Rushmore, but Rushmores, but we're going to have, because there's so many ways you can take this, so we're going to have to do it probably by category. I mean, you can have your all-time personal Mount Rushmore, and then you can have Mount Rushmores by category as well. Now, yesterday, I started it off with, you know what, I categorized mine as a Mount Rushmore 2.0. Okay, so I'm going to keep it at that 2.0. But there were, out of the Mount Rushmores mentioned yesterday, other than myself, I mean, they had Warren and Beasley. You guys had, I mean, real solid Mount Rushmores. And one of those, and we just played the audio of him, about him, William Washington Brown. Thank you, Beasley, again for that. Didn't know about him, but, you know, this guy started out life as a slave, and one of his accomplishments, I mean, talk about. He did a few things, but he started the first black-owned bank in the United States. That's very worthy of Mount Rushmore. So I wanted to do, you know, something that headlined him. I'm trying to get some other audios. But tomorrow we're going to go into... I'm going to put out another category of Mount Rushmore and then see, you know, how people can fill in the blanks on that. But anyway, to William Washington Brown, if I had to do a black Mount Rushmore, and, you know, another one category that Beasley put up yesterday was the unknown black inventor. I think that's paraphrasing, that's what he stated yesterday. That, man, that's a solid Mount Rushmore category. Well, you can break it down as category or just period. I mean, you can take the unknown black inventor and replace him or replace one of the current Route Mushmore people, well, that's Washington, Lincoln, Teddy Roosevelt, and Thomas Jefferson. Take your pick, man. That one entry, the unknown black inventor, in my opinion, can take the place of what's currently on Mount Rushmore right now. But anyway, so tomorrow we're going to do we're going to play around with it tomorrow with different categories of Mount Rushmore. But from yesterday, William Washington Brown. What an achievement. The first black-owned bank. Then this guy started out life as a slave. Okay. Now, as I do more research on him, and I'm trying to find other audio that I can link up here. If not, we'll have to make up something. But I wanted to talk, and if you guys want to talk about it more during the podcast, we can do that too. I wanted to play a couple of audios on a topic. I listen to Jamaican radio, via YouTube. And I heard a twist on reparations that I haven't heard before, and that's basically Jamaican people, black Jamaicans who mostly, well, you got all kinds of, Jamaica's diverse, they got a diverse culture. You got Asian Jamaicans and white Jamaicans and German Jamaicans. But I was hearing this morning that there's a significant segment of Jamaica, with your fellow countrymen, that want reparations. So I'm going to play, I'm going to play one audio of talking about reparations for Jamaica. Because it's a different point of view, And then we're going to play another one from a prominent black person in England that didn't know that his ancestors were slave owners. So we're going to play that and then, you know, take your comments and contributions as well.
It's time for news from around the world. And meanwhile in... Meanwhile, in Jamaica, they've got a pretty interesting proposal. They're apparently preparing to request compensation from Britain over its role in the transatlantic slave trade back in the 17th and 18th centuries, when at least 600,000 Africans were shipped to the Caribbean as enslaved people. There are multiple people involved in this effort, but I want to focus first on Olivia Grange, Jamaica's Minister of Sports, Youth, and Culture, who told Reuters that her government would seek reparatory justice in all forms to repair the damages that our ancestors experienced. And depending on where you look, different dollar values have been attributed to this, that they might be requesting $5 billion or $7 billion or $10 billion. But why? Well, Olivia Grange says our African ancestors were forcibly removed from their home and suffered unparalleled atrocities in Africa to carry out forced labor to the benefit of the British Empire. And the most amazing thing, though, is one of the reasons that they say this is merited, and it's historically grounded, you got to listen to this. The petition is connected to a motion filed by a Jamaican lawmaker, Mike Henry, to seek more than $10 billion, his estimate of how much enslavers received in compensation after Britain abolished slavery, freeing an estimated 800,000 enslaved black people back in 1834. Britain made those disbursements after taking out a mammoth loan, the interest on which it finished paying only in 2015, which is amazing, and I didn't know that. But they're asking for, like, oh, so you can give that money to the slaveholders, but not the people who are enslaved, or the government that's trying to represent them. So it's a pretty amazing idea, Vivian. I don't know necessarily that it will work, but what do you think about it?
I mean, they have every right, and they should. I mean, more blood has been spilled in Jamaica and in all of the Caribbean. It's absolutely horrible. Genocide, I mean, if you recall, Jamaica was where Columbus touched down in 1494, and when he started eradicating the, you know, Taino people, the Arawak people, and then the slave trade started shortly after that, you know, and this is a country that more has suffered so much and has generational trauma. Of course they should have redress. Of course they should be compensated for this. I don't think they will. I think it's a really great position to take, and I think it will maybe lead the charge for a lot of other Caribbean nations and a lot of other countries that suffered greatly. I mean, but really all of, like, North America, the Caribbean, South America, all of that, not to mention Europe and Africa. I mean, the slave trade was absolutely massive. So this, if this actually takes hold, we're going to see a lot other people following suit.
Yeah. Which is one reason why I think that it probably won't. But it's a good argument, and it certainly, at the very least, starts a conversation. Want to give you a little bit more information. So they say enslaved people transported to the Caribbean were forced to work in dire conditions on sugar and crop plantations where deadly diseases were rife. As many as 20 million African men, women, and children were enslaved during this period. But it wasn't a racial thing, you know. That's what I learned on Fox News. It was just, I mean, sure, it was bad or whatever, but it wasn't a racial thing that they were doing. And think about how much money would eventually be made over this period of time by Britain. The initial money that they made, all of the investment that was then put into, like, they have benefited so much. They're only asking for $10 billion. Seems pretty reasonable when you put it in that historical context.
Even after the slave trade supposedly ended, slavery continued through indentured servitude and, of course, abuse. I mean, we see it all over the Caribbean, of course, even going into Cuba, which is the whole reason that the revolution began and, you know, unfortunately started an oppressive regime, all those helping people come out of slavery and giving Afro-Cubans and really, I mean, validating the African people. I mean, that's why Nelson Mandela met with Fidel as soon as he came out of jail, because there were few people fighting for Africans around the globe. And so I really applaud Jamaica, and I really hope that there is something, some respect given to this proposal.
Yeah, that's a great point. For more political news, breakdowns, interviews, stories of activism, and me trying my hardest to care about the occasional big celebrity news story, subscribe to our YouTube channel at youtube.com/thedamagereport. And you can ring the bell wherever it is so you don't miss anything.
All right, now we're going to have another podcast, might end up next week, where I'm recruiting some Jamaicans, authentic Jamaicans, and we're going to have a powwow on their view, at least the people I'm able to rustle up for the podcast, on reparations for Jamaicans. I'm going to see if I can get at least opposing points of view from native-born Jamaicans. Now, the next audio we're going to play, we're going to get there with Mount Rushmore, too, will be about, from a prominent black person, lives in England, Ainsley Harriet, who is a celebrity chef in the UK, lives in England. Used to have a syndicated show that used to be in the United States. I know some of you might have caught it some years ago. But now his ancestors were actually slave owners. So when it comes to reparations, some Jamaicans want England to pay for reparations. Should black slave owners in the UK because the United States had over 4,000 black slave owners. Should they be able to pay? I mean, not able, but should their descendants pay reparations today? Anyway, here's Ainsley Harriet.
Ainsley has returned to the Jamaica archives to see if he can find anything that will take him further down the Harriet line.
How are you, Ainsley?
I'm fantastic. How are you doing?
Come on.
First, he searches for information on Ebenezer's baptism and finds an entry on the International Genealogical Index website.
Ebenezer Harriet Mell, birth 22nd of August, 1865.
This gives him Ebenezer's father's name, James Gordon Harriet, the key to tracing back the Harriet line.
Amazing, this. James Gordon Harriet.
Now he can look for James's baptism registration.
Is this for James Gordon Harriet? This is a record of his...
This is...
birth.
One. Oh, it was a baptism.
Baptism. Okay. Yeah, there it is. Look, look.
Mm.
June the 15th, James Gordon Harriet. Is it...
Reputed
son... of George Harriet by, is that Bridget?
Bridget, yes.
Bridget de...
Dexcherie.
De Cherie.
Mm-hmm.
Born November the 22nd, 1803. Baptism of white children in 1806. That's my great-great-grandfather. I mean, it says baptism of white children. So the Harriet was... originally a white name then.
Yes.
I need to sit down. This is so sorry. I'm not uncomfortable with it. It's extraordinary. That is amazing, man.
This extraordinary document reveals that Ebenezer Harriet's father, James Gordon Harriet, Ainsley's great-great-grandfather, was white and was born before the abolition of slavery.
On checking, I found property that he actually owned.
Oh,
yes.
More property.
Yes.
Jamaica SS, a return of slaves in the parish of Manchester.
In the possession?
In the possession. Sorry, James Gordon Harriet as owner. Mm-hmm. On the 28th day of June, in the year of our Lord, 1825. Oh, my word.
He owned 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 slaves.
I can see that.
No, actually.
My great-great-grandfather was a slave owner. Well, I don't know what to say. This is just quite amazing. That one moment you're feeling this almost hatred for people who dominated and controlled and at times abused my 3 times great mother, mm-hmm. Catherine Smith, and getting so angry with being in that church up in Manchester and looking at that plaque,
mm-hmm.
of John Davy, and yet my own grandfather, only twice removed, was a slave owner himself.
Yes.
Fucking hell. Sorry. Didn't expect this at all. I always expected them to be a bit of a colour, and looking at Ebenezer there, I expected a little bit of something, but I always thought there was a colour all the way down the line.
Ebenezer's mother, Priscilla, was black, but would not have been a slave, as Ebenezer was born 27 years after slavery. As white slave owners, James Gordon Harriet's family is well documented. His father, George David, was born in Jamaica in 1781. He owned a 400-acre estate, Hopeton, and 30 slaves. Diane has found a deed of sale between George David and his father that shows owning slaves went back generations in the Harriet family.
Okay, this is between George David and the parish of St. Elizabeth County of Cornwall.
Yes, the county of Cornwall.
Okay.
Cornwall, Jamaica.
Yeah.
An infant of the age of 4 years old. Now, you'd wonder what financial transaction could a four-year-old be partaking in. But guess what? This is what he was purchasing for a few shillings. Negro slaves to wit: Sancho, Caesar, London, Oxford, Duke, August, Charity, Mary, Camellia, Phoebe, Jenny, Delia, Sylvia, Grace, and Rachel, with the future issue, offspring, and increase of the females of the said slaves. He actually purchased these slaves from his father. So his father gave him 10 shillings and then took back the 10 shillings and gave him slaves in lieu of the 10 shillings.
It's ridiculous. I mean, it's a four-year-old child. What does a four-year-old child know? So this was something that was passed down through the family, mm-hmm. learning the skill and art
of purchasing your slaves.
Of purchasing slaves. It's amazing, isn't it, that you just dealing with people's lives like that, with you know, just getting money and you're talking about human beings here. At the moment, I feel as if I've learnt about the family history, but I'm not necessarily very proud of what they did. I can't begin to comprehend what it must have been like to have had children that
you bring up to show them how to purchase slaves, to purchase another fellow human being. This is shocking. And I'm probably glad to say that as we sort of move down the line, things seem to become a little bit not so shitty, really.
All right, well, Ainsley Harriet, who's a celebrity chef out of the UK, and I'm sure he's got plenty of content on YouTube and places like that online. As Brother Warren mentioned yesterday, slavery is a very complex topic. So you've got some African-Americans and you have some Afro-Jamaicans, and actually the whole Western Hemisphere, where, like in the case of Jamaica, the blacks that want, or black Jamaicans who want reparations specifically from England. But like in the case of Ainsley Harriet, and he's just one among many, because his roots are Jamaican, but as he just found out, to his undelight, that he has ancestors not that far removed that were slave owners, going from even from the tender age of just 4 years old. So, in 2021 and beyond, should Ainsley Harriet and his estate, and if he has any other siblings, should they be on the hook to pay reparations? And, of course, reparations means different things to different people. Some people might want Ainsley Harriet to cut a check. Or, hey, some of those acres that your family had, you know, give us 40 acres of it. So, as Warren said, it's a very complex subject. But I'm recruiting some Jamaicans so we can do a live stream on that and have you guys chime in on that. Now, another, and tomorrow we're going back to do a Mount Rushmore thing, because there's so many different categories you can go with Mount Rushmore. But one of the categories of Mount Rushmore yesterday, I think this was brought up by Brother Warren, Wake Up New Orleans, here on Blog Talk Radio. I think African males or African children. Well, Warren, you can straighten me out on how you phrased that yesterday. But matter of fact, I would say my favorite African innovator, and man, I've tried to get him on the show. He's one of my Facebook friends, but he's difficult. White folks have snatched him up. It's hard to get him now. William Kamwamba. Disney did a movie about him, The Boy Who Harnessed the Wind. The book that he wrote, The Boy Who Harnessed the Wind, and it's an audio book also. Before we go to phone lines, here's William himself doing a TED Talk, telling his story. And what if we had to do, I don't know, you can stick William into probably a few Mount Rushmore categories. But for my own Mount Rushmore of African innovators, modern African venerate or contemporary African innovators. I don't know. He would be my number one pick. He'd be my first slot. Now, I don't know who the other three are. You know, because it's a few of my I like, but this guy would be number one. So thank you, Warren, for bringing that up yesterday. And then we're going to go to the phone lines. The primary one that we featured today, which you played some audio earlier, William Washington Brown, who was the first person born a slave that started a bank right here in the United States. I mean, that if we had to do a national Mount Rushmore, I think you got to stick him in there. Anyway, William Kimwamba, and then we'll go to the phone lines.
Thank you. 2 years ago, I stood on the third stage in Arusha, Tanzania. I spoke very briefly about one of my proudest creation. It was a simple machine that changed my life. Before that time, I had never been away from my home in Malawi. I had never used the computer. I had never seen an internet. On stage that day, I was so nervous. My English lost. I wanted to vomit. I had never been surrounded by so many Azungu, white people. There was a story I couldn't tell you then, but well, I'm feeling good right now. I'd like to share that story today. We are 7 children in my family, all sisters excepting me. This is me with my dad when I was a little boy. Before I discovered the wonders of science, I was just a simple farmer in a country of poor farmers. Like everyone else, we grew maize. One year, our fortune turned very bad. In 2001, we experienced an awful famine. Within 5 months, all Malawians began to starve to death. My family ate 1 meal per day at night, only 3 swallows of sima for each one of us. The food passes through our bodies. We drop down to nothing. In Malawi, secondary school, you have to pay school fees. Because of the hunger, I was forced to drop out of school. I looked at my father and looked those dry fields. It was the future I couldn't accept. I felt very happy to be at the first year of secondary school. So, I was determined to do anything possible to receive education. So, I went to a library. I read books, science books, especially physics. I couldn't read English that well. I used diagrams and pictures to learn the words around them. Another book put that knowledge in my hands. It said, windmill could pump water and generate electricity. Pump water meant irrigation, a defense against hunger, which were experiencing by that time. So I decided I'll build one windmill for myself. But I didn't have materials to use. So I went to a scrapyard where I found my materials. Many people, including my mother, said I was crazy. I found a tractor fan, shock absorber, PVC pipes, using a bicycle frame, and the old bicycle dynamo, I built my machine. It was 1 light at first, and then 4 lights with switches, and even a circuit breaker modeled after an electric bell. Another machine pumps water for irrigation. Queues of people start lining up at my house to charge their mobile phone. I could not get rid of them. And the reporters came too, which led to bloggers, and which led to a call from something called Ted. I had never seen an aeroplane before. I had never slept in a hotel. So, on stage that day in Arusha, my English lost. I said something like, I tried and I made it. So I would like to say something to all the people out there, like me, to the Africans and the poor who are struggling with your dreams. God bless. Maybe one day you watch this on the internet. I said to you, trust yourself and believe. Whatever happens, don't give it up. Thank you.
Okay, that was William Kimwamba himself. I know the first year, and I've been doing It's My House for like 7 years, I've tried to get him on but was not successful at it so far. Still trying. I got my second one on. All right, today, thanks to Beasley yesterday, William Washington Brown, the first Black person who, and he was Beasley's, one of Beasley's selections for a Mount Rushmore, and very good selection. And like I said, tomorrow we're going to pick back up on, because I'm going to put out some different categories about Mount Rushmore, but he definitely good selection. And like future shows, like I said, we're going to do Jamaican reparations. I just put out a text to a friend of mine who's native-born Jamaican. I'm going to see if I asked her, could she round up a panel of about four people and whatnot. Anyway, we're going to come back with William Washington Brown, Jamaican reparations, should the UK, should England pay reparations? Because, you know, should black folk who discover that they have ancestors who were slave owners, should their descendants today be held accountable legally and financially to pay reparations today? Those are some of the questions, or anything you guys want to talk about. We'll be back in 2 minutes. Bye. Today's podcast is titled William Washington Brown, who was brought to at least my attention. Some other people might have known about him. I didn't. But Connie Beasley brought him up because we were the topic yesterday was I put out a version, one of my versions of Mount Rushmore. A lot of times when people do Mount Rushmore, it's sports related. I based and I'm going to say one of my categories of Mount Rushmore, because I titled it Mount Rushmore 2.0. Now, my version of Mount Rushmore 2.0 is based on, to a very high degree, thinking outside the box, or off the, what I call, in this case, off the grid. My four for Mount Rushmore 2.0, LA's 2.0, and I'm looking at the common denominator. These guys basically went off the grid, and two of them are pioneers in new industries. Was Bezos, because there's a fire engine going past my house. Jeff Bezos, who successfully launched Blue Origin yesterday. I had him on the list. Barack Obama, first black president of the United States. Sir Richard Branson of Virgin Airlines, but he successfully went into space with Virgin Galactic. And Bezos, and the reason why I put Mount Rushmore 2.0 / off the grid is because those two guys, I mean, what they did within the last 2 weeks, actually last 2 to 3 weeks, hasn't even been a month yet. Between those two, space is a new industry. New industry. Matter of fact, it's so new, there are people that haven't even been born yet that 10 years from now, 15 years from now, 20, even 30 years from now, they'll still be pioneers. It just opens up so many possibilities. So that's why I put Bezos and Branson in my Mount Rushmore 2.0. Which, like I say, we're talking about pioneer people. Even with Barack Obama, you know, how he used social media to win a national election. pioneer. And the fourth person that I had on my Mount Rushmore 2.0, as a matter of fact, you know what? The golden cord that runs through my 2.0, they're all pioneers. Bezos pioneered with e-commerce and social commerce, pioneered with Blue Origin and space travel for civilians. Sir Richard Branson with Virgin Galactic. That's a different division. That's a different pony from Virgin Atlantic. Virgin Galactic, he's a pioneer, okay? And Donald Trump, my fourth person in my Mount Rushmore 2.0, another pioneer, because Donald Trump, who never ran for office, all right, he's the second person that essentially got elected via social media, so to speak. Those two, Barack Obama and Donald Trump, no matter what you think about them, they mastered a realm of communication, mass communication, that the old boy network that had more money than Barack Obama when he started out and had as much as Donald Trump and or more, because most of your senators are uber rich. Jeb Bush, who came from a political family and had $100 million in his war chest, Trump whipped his ass. When it came to media, social media, he whipped them all. And then people in his own Republican Party badmouthed him, ganged up on him, and they still couldn't beat him because Trump is a master of, when it comes to politics, on a national level, he's a master at it. Even with Twitter, I think Twitter has banned him and Facebook has banned him too. He doesn't even need them. He doesn't even need those two platforms. The man, he's a master at media. In relationship to the average standard American politician, you can't dispute it. You might not like him, but you can't dispute the man. He's a man. So that's the, all for my 2.0 Mount Rushmore yesterday. They were all pioneers. Civilian space travel. I mean, Virgin Galactic's taking reservations, and so is Blue Origin. You know, I don't know how many millions of dollars it costs to buy a ticket, but you can contact both of them right now online, and they'll give you all the information you need and how much it costs. Blue Origin's got two more flights planned for this year. And you can contact Galactic. I got to get used to saying Virgin Galactic, because Virgin Atlantic is the airline part. Now it's for the uber rich right now, because it costs millions of dollars to book your reservation. However, I say within the next 5 to 10 years. Definitely, I would say within 15 years, I think definitely less than 20, that space vacations will be in reach of, you know what, let's see. I'm gauging this like the internet, because now, if you look at it, basically anybody on the planet can get a cell phone or a smartphone. You have people in rural Africa in rural India, in rural parts of the world, Philippines, you name it, rural parts of Asia or whatever, they've got smartphones. Okay. So, you can get an internet connection. And you got people in the Serengeti that do mobile banking now. So I'd say, now I'm just guesstimating here. I think it'll be less than 20 years. Less than 20 years, you'll have middle class people. I don't know about poor people yet, but you'll have middle class people that will be, I mean, it will be no big idea for them to do a weekend in space at a space station motel, hotel. I don't know about trips to Mars or the moon, but there'll be space stations around the globe and other entrepreneurs that might not even been born yet as of right now in 2021. They'll be into the game because they're going to see things that we don't see, and they're going to create opportunities. So they'll, I mean, right now you got Bezos, you got Sir Richard Branson, Elon Musk. I think he's got a space program going too. But there are going to be other people that are not on the radar yet that are going to get into this. And there'll be some black people that get into this too. And in any event, let's go to the phone lines here. Okay, 346. Your mic is open. 346. All right, 346 going. Oh, wait a minute. Blog Talk played a trick on me. Okay, 346, your mic is open. Hello?
Okay, good morning, LA.
Oh, good morning, Warren.
Yeah, I just wanted to go back to this concept of reparations that you were talking about earlier.
Mm-hmm.
It is, in my best opinion, that I think the concept of the whole concept of reparations really just need to be left alone. It's too much of a mess and mix and mar to actually allow reparations to be paid out. And if you want to talk in terms of black folks, because there were plenty of black slave owners at the time, in reparations instead of looking at the government, because, again, if you search the history, it wasn't the government that owned slaves. It was companies, corporations, and private individuals. Going back also down in history, one of the reasons why people looking at slavery as if it was a black and white issue, it did not start as a black and white issue. It morphed into a black and white issue because of the ignorance and because of people not understanding what happened. Even the concept of the type of commercialism that we had today as opposed to then. Today, we operate in capitalism. Well, back then, we didn't operate in capitalism. We operated up under what's called mercantilism, which has to do with trade. And that's why you have the 13 British colonies who are operating as a trade, making money for the crown. And so this is one of the reasons why slavery became a popular thing, dealing with trades, tariffs, and taxes. That's what was supposed to make a country strong. So, again, in the beginning, you had black slaves as well as white slaves. And the thing ended up morphing into black slaves over white slaves because black folks were more easy to spot. Black folks were the hardest workers over whites. People who had white slaves ended up usually bringing them back, wanting their money back because they couldn't handle the heat, the pressures, and things that we handle. And, again, you know, you have plenty of black slaves then. So the whole commercial system of mercantilism, we don't operate up under that no more, which strengthens slavery as for tax purposes and tariffs and trade, as up under the capitalism, which system now is basically you have an idea It's not based on trade and how much trade, and whether you cut off to a certain amount of trade or not, but capitalism is based off of your idea and you being able to market that idea to the general public and be able to make money off that idea, which is a better concept than mercantilism. So mercantilism and trade is what drove slavery. We don't have that. And it's just as much as you have black slave owners, you have people with white skin who actually, if they research the history, they're tied to black folks or they themselves ancestors were slaves. So it's digging off into too much that we'll never get a true answer for. That's my comment.
Well, should it be left alone? Let me ask you this. Now you've got the city of Asheville, North Carolina. You've got, Illinois. They've passed some kind of resolution. And then Detroit, Michigan, is working on a reparations bill itself. Now, none of these three cities are basing their reparations based on slavery. They're coming up mm-hmm. with their own definition of reparations. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, you know, if the states do have certain rights, and if that's what those states decide they want to do, then fine.
Well, hold on. These are not states. These are three cities within those states.
Oh,
like,
you say
the state
cities.
Of Illinois is not on board with this. It's just the city of Evansville, Asheville, and Detroit.
Okay, repeat that statement again. What did you say?
When it comes to reparations, the state of Asheville, North Carolina, is the only city that I know of in the state of North Carolina that is trying to work out a reparations bill. For the city of Asheville, the state of North Carolina has nothing on the table, to my knowledge, for that. Detroit, Michigan, is trying to work out a reparations bill on the local city level, but not the state of Michigan. And in Illinois, Evansville, Illinois, has passed some type of resolution for reparations for the city of Evansville, Illinois, but not the state of Illinois. So none of the states is just those three cities that I know about so far. And none of those three cities, particularly Detroit and Evansville, ever had slaves.
See, those are things to think about. I mean, if the city, which the cities are municipal areas, they're corporations, and if they have that kind of money or they think that's somehow going to stimulate their economy, then so be it. I mean, I guess. I mean, it doesn't make any sense, especially if you said he never even had slaves. But from a federal level, the whole concept of reparations, I think, need to be left alone. Now, there are certain issues. Now, let's go to North Carolina. When you talk about the Wilmington insurrection of 1898, well, the blacks in Wilmington need to be paid reparations because it was the Democratic Party who ran them out of there and killed them. So when you can directly things that are that nature, or slavery, or things of that nature to the federal government, then, of course, the federal government needs to pay. But when you talk indirectly, when you talk about a federal government who inherited a problem that was already here from the colonies, you know, the United States, we talk, we've been in bondage over here for 400 years. Well, when did the United States start? The United States didn't start in 1775, 1776. And so slavery from the time the United States started in 1865 was only 89 years. Well, there are atrocities, of course, but it shows you that 89 years, to me, is a pretty good time to end something that you inherited, something that you don't want. You had the argument of slavery, the free states and slave states is what started the colonies from the beginning. You had free states and slave states from its inception because a lot of the people were not with slavery. Everybody didn't buy into that concept. And it's even in the documents of the Articles of Association that was written in 1774.
Right. Well, prior to the United States, even now, people gravitate to geographical areas where they have more freedoms, less government.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And at that time, what we would call, what we now call the United States, was wide open territory in street slang parlance. Because if you look at the guys who signed the Declaration of Independence, the United States dollar did not exist. As a matter of fact, they didn't even draw up legislation for that until 16 years after they signed the after the United States was actually
right.
formally formed.
Right, exactly.
So the United States dollar didn't exist. They still prospered. Anthony Johnson, who you can probably call one of the architects of American slavery.
Modern day.
He was black.
Black man.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He didn't do bad, well. I mean, he did well. He did well. A lot of the government agencies that you have on a local level, state level, and federal level did not exist back then. Hell, most of the people who signed the Declaration of Independence, if not all of them, they didn't even have there was no such thing as running water or indoor plumbing as we know it today. There were no light bulbs, so they lived in a totally different world than we live today.
Yeah.
But it was wide open, where you can do what you want to do and get as wealthy as you want to do. Now, today, there's more rules and regulations. You know, I think every one of the people who signed the Declaration of Independence, now I don't know none of those dudes, obviously, but I don't think they were like the United States the way it is today, because it's more restrictive than it was back then. You know, basically.
Well, definitely,
you know,
one thing I definitely know that they wouldn't like about it, and that is how the Constitution has been manipulated.
Right.
Yeah.
The
Constitution has definitely been manipulated to bring in things that would actually destroy this place.
It has been. It has been.
And as you mentioned, it's just so funny how things switch around, because you said people tend to go where they have more freedoms at. And that's
right.
Exactly what most of America who do not understand today, who sit up and say Republican Party are agents. It was the Republican Party that was created for the abolishment of slavery. And not only the abolishment of slavery, but to create less government to get out of your business and let you have free reign of your business as long as your business was not intruding upon someone else. But we rally around democracy. The word itself, democracy, democracy, which is a socialism type thing, which actually puts people in chains because it brings in more government and it cuts out your freedom and allows government to be in charge and to control what you do. And this is the foolishness that's being taught and told by people.
And that's sort of how It's My House got started, because the house in Washington, D.C., I had a house sitter that I found out had more rights than I did, and it took me like two and a half years, almost three, to get that person out of the house. Now, that wouldn't have happened 20 years prior to that. But
no,
you know, that's why I've gone rural, because in rural locations, not all rural locations, but there's a lot more than city locations. In rural locations, there's a lot less rules and regulations. So the problems that you might have in a D.C., a Chicago, Los Angeles, San Francisco, some of those places, you're not going to have them in, you know, smaller areas that have a population of maybe 5,000 people or less. And then you have a lot of people that come to the United States because they have more freedom in this country than the country that they came from. You know, depending on what city that they land in.
You see everybody trying to come to America. You don't see nobody trying to break out of America. You see everybody trying to come here.
Mm-hmm.
And it just shows how spoiled we are, because, you know, if you talk to your average immigrant, if you talk to your average immigrant, at least the most ones I've talked to, you know, all of them tell me of some heavy atrocities and things they face in their country and how glad they are to be here and how much better it is from what they come from. But you talk to the average person here in America or the average black man, you know, they talk more on destroying this place and hating this place than anything else. And so sometimes they used to say, we don't miss our water till the well run dry.
Right. Right. Now, within the United States, there are people that are leaving a lot of your coastal towns that are heavily populated in California and moving to other places within the United States. One of those places is Texas.
Yeah, and that's what we get of. You talking about, I didn't mean to keep cutting you off, but when you that just triggers something in me because look at these places. California is a Democratic state.
Mm-hmm.
New York, although Republican, New York City is Democratic. And all these places that are Democratic, Chicago, look at Philadelphia, all these heavily populated Democratic places, you see nothing but poverty. And so Texas being a red state has caused these people to leave where they can't even afford no more and come to Texas and threaten the liberties that we enjoy here as a Republican state.
Mm-hmm. Warren, now, you've got black folk. I've been hearing about black folk moving to Texas for over the last 20 years or so, particularly Houston. Why do you think that is? Because you're in Houston.
Well, that's what I'm saying. The liberties and things. Houston is Texas itself, not only just Houston, but the whole state, I used to say, was like a best-kept secret. You know, now that they moved here, you know, you used to get easily for around about $150,000, $180,000. Man, you get a 2,500-square-feet home, 3-4-bedroom, you know, bathroom. I mean, all this stuff that you couldn't even think about getting in California and New York. And so now by them moving here, they have driven up the price and everything is going up. Everything is going up. And you know, where you used to get an apartment, you know, 2-3-bedroom apartment for $500 or $600 a month. That's no more. You know, you're not going to get an apartment for under $1,000 now. And that's even talking about a 1-bedroom. So everything is driving the cost up with these people moving here. And the thing is, it's one thing to move to Texas, but when you start bringing your liberal mindset, it's going to change the climate that's in Texas.
Well, now, Texas has got over 200 counties exist in Texas. And now what I've discovered, because I went to undergraduate school up in the Panhandle, West Texas A&M University now, up in Canyon, Texas, 17 miles south of Amarillo. But I bought 10 acres of land in far west Texas in Presidio County. And, I mean, it's desert and mountains. But the 10 acres only cost me $2,000. That's $200 an acre. So,
yeah.
Nobody started to move out that way yet. But Texas has got a lot of opportunities.
Yes,
and it also has the three largest cities in the United States. One which you just named, Houston, and I imagine the same thing's happening with San Antonio and the Dallas Metroplex, which is a huge area. I've been to all three of those areas too, but like I say, there's a lot more to Texas that. You know, Texas got a lot of, like, little towns
as well.
So,
yes, indeed.
Now, Warren, I'm going to ask you, we did this yesterday. Tomorrow we're going to do it. You don't have to give it to me today. We asked people to name their Mount Rushmore, non-sports, but I put out my Mount Rushmore 2.0, and that's four people that you think that had an impact on the United States and or the world. And we're going to get to that in a moment. Let me take the next call, though. 410 area code, your mic is open.
Any surgery? Recent surgery?
Mm-hmm.
Any cancer history?
Mm-hmm.
Area code 410.
Close your head.
Area code 410. Okay, well, their mic is open. They might have.
Over here.
Area code 410.
Put both arms up. Push up. And down.
Okay. All right, well, we gonna put them on mute. Warren, did you watch the space launch yesterday?
I caught it briefly. I didn't watch the whole thing, but I saw it briefly when I was getting ready to walk out the door.
All right, they, that took place in Texas, Van Horn, Texas.
Yeah, was Jeff Bezos supposed to be on that show?
Yeah, he was on it. He was on it. His brother was on it, and the youngest person ever going to space, he was on it from Holland, and then Wally Funk, who probably has more fly time than most females. She's 82. She was on it too. Those four people, and it took off from a site near Van Horn, Texas, which you can buy land in Van Horn cheap. If you've been out that way, it's probably a lot of desert and mountains out that way.
Yeah.
But, it was maybe, all told, it was probably no more than, I think under 12 minutes. It was all under 15 minutes, everything.
Yeah. Yeah. So how long are they supposed to be out there?
They did this first successful flight yesterday, a manned flight, because they did unmanned flights before. So this was the first solo manned flight of Blue Origin. They have two more planned before the end of this year, but it's a private enterprise. So they are selling tickets for future space rides.
I think it's like, what, $28 million or something like that?
It's up there. But like anything else, I mean, at one time, computers, access to computers was high, and then at one time, fax machines were like really giant and colossal and very expensive. But as more and more people get on board, so to speak, the prices dramatically get low. So it's just like, you know, I remember the first cell phone I had, which was a brick, that's what they would call it today, a brick. I forgot how much that brick cost, but it was expensive. And just to get a 15-minute airtime to talk on it, it took quite a long time just to charge it up. But now, well, the brick's gone out of business, and now you have people you got people in developing countries that have cell phones and internet service. So, I think that was the same thing with anything. It seems like every, I don't know, 6 months or so, prices drop as technology gets better and more people can afford it. That's going to happen with space travel. Space travel for civilians.
It's based on supply and demand. You know, it's like I remember when VCRs first came out, VCRs, even the beta machines and VCRs was like over $1,000. And the prices slowly dropped to now VCR is not worth anything because technology has changed.
Right.
And so, as you say, it'd be the same thing with the space shuttle.
It'll
start dropping.
I remember TV stations. Now, this was back when I went to college in the 70s. Basically, only TV stations, early 70s, no, mid 70s, TV stations had VCRs. And maybe the media lab at various universities and maybe some school systems. But, you know, a short year later, everybody had one. Okay. And then as technology improved, like you said, I mean, who needs one now? I got one laying around the house that I don't use. I stream everything now. So space travel, you know, I think will, you know, thing, because I'm sure at one time, you know, catching the train was a luxury. Or riding in, that's what made Henry Ford rich. He basically made the car, automobile, he made it to the point where, a certain group, I guess middle class people, could afford it with the Model T. And then as more and more people bought it, then everybody can afford one. So let me see if Beasley's still here.
It's a little failing the flusher line.
410 area code.
You just got the blood with no problem at all.
410 area code.
So I took my time. Mm-hmm. And I looked for the vein that I wanted.
Okay. Sounds like somebody's in a medical procedure with that.
Yeah.
Anyway. Let's see, before we sign off, if you had to pick a Mount Rushmore for African American achievement, can you think of four people?
Can I think of four people?
Let me put out what Beasley put out yesterday, if I can remember. He put out William Washington Brown, who was born a slave, but he founded the first black-owned and operated bank. He did other things, but that's one of the top achievements, William Washington Brown. He also selected what he titled the unknown black inventor as part of his Mount Rushmore. I forgot the other two that he named. Booker T. Washington. I think he was in his Mount Rushmore. And when we used the starting five format, he put in Al Sharpton, not for his politics, but for Al Sharpton's ability to galvanize and organize people and get their attention and make them act on something. I forgot the other person that he named. So I'll just put that as his Mount Rushmore. Now, my Mount Rushmore, I think I named earlier, was I called it Mount Rushmore 2.0. Wasn't based strictly on black. As a matter of fact, I only had one black person in it, but I put in Bezos based on pioneering. My four were based on pioneering. Bezos, space travel, and e-commerce with Amazon. Barack Obama for his use of the internet and social media for getting elected to a national office. Donald Trump, same thing. Social media, and I looked at Donald Trump as like a media pioneer, particularly using social media to get elected president of the United States. Where the old boy network has not won a national seat using social media yet. I don't know if you would include Biden in that, but I would say Biden, to a high degree, used the same people that Barack Obama used to get elected. So, and then Sir Richard Branson was the last person I had. With Virgin Galactic, because he launched a successful space flight mission 2-3 weeks ago. So my four were based on pioneers.
Yeah, pioneers is always good in the aspect of doing something. But if I had to I guess, pick a route of Mount Rushmore in the sense of a black Mount Rushmore. Mine would be Booker T. Washington, for pioneering pretty much career in agriculture in the black community. Mm-hmm. It would be in politics, it would also be a Martin Luther King and a Malcolm X, as well as a Thurgood Marshall in the legal aspect, in the legal field.
Okay, well, those are four good selections. If I had to do, and like I said, tomorrow we're going to put up different categories of Mount Rushmore. If I had to do a black Mount Rushmore, I had to take something from Beasley with actually two selections from Beasley. William Washington Brown, once again, he's a black former slave that started, the first black owned and operated bank. He also selected Booker T. Washington. So I agree with both of you on that. I would also select Frank McWhorter, who changed his name legally to Free Frank McWhorter, who was the first documented black person to start his own town, his own municipality in the United States. I got to put him in there as my third selection. And Beasley had a selection called The Unknown Black Inventor, which is a very good, I got a tie. Between that and the first election of Barack Obama. But then again, I got a three-way tie. Paul Cuffey, who was a black shipbuilder during colonial times, who basically helped organize the first successful back-to-Africa trip, which helped form the nation of Sierra Leone that we know today. I got those three as a three. Yeah, Obama, Paul Cuffey, what was the other one I named? Anyway, that's where we're going to do that tomorrow. Let's see if Beasley is free. 410 area code, you there?
Yes, I'm here.
Okay.
Can you hear me?
Your comments or contributions, Brother Beasley?
Well, I'm in the middle of signing some papers. That's why I heard you, but I had to get these papers signed.
Okay.
Look, my Mount Rushmore yesterday was the unknown African slave.
Ah, okay.
And the other one was William Washington Brown.
Mm-hmm.
And the last one was Al Sharpton.
Okay.
And my reasons for that was everything that goes on the globe today came off the backs of African slaves. You'd have no economies. You'd have no capitalism. You'd have no socialism. You'd have no communism. You wouldn't have anything if slavery had not occurred in this country. You wouldn't have one of the greatest economies in the world. You wouldn't have any imperialism whatsoever, whether it's the British Empire or the American imperialistic system today that mainly controls the world, because all of that came off the backs of slaves. Even the technologies that we enjoy today came from the genius of blacks in this country, whether it's science, medicine, whether it's engineering, what have you. And the thing is, that's why I picked the unknown African slave.
You know what? That's worthy, in my opinion, of a monument. Just like they had the tomb of the unknown soldier in Arlington, Virginia, outside of D.C. That yeah. is definitely worthy of a monument.
Yeah. In fact,
I would say even more so than Martin Luther King.
Yeah, in fact, you wouldn't have an American Revolution if it hadn't been for slavery. Think about it. I mean, the colonists wouldn't have had the power to overthrow the British crown if it hadn't been for slavery. So with that being the case, you know, when you have these arguments about reparations, you know, I marvel at them because the simple thing is nobody knows what a key player, what an important piece slavery played in the globe today, whether it's the Chinese economy, whether it's the Japanese economy, you name it. You wouldn't have anything today to resemble what it is today if it hadn't been for slavery in this country. Now, you know, I got the naysayers out there, but they can't dispute that. Because America has the most powerful military in the world today. And all of that comes from slavery and the wealth that was built through slavery. So, you know, you can come with all kinds of arguments that you want to. But the thing is, and look, you know the British crown had an empire that the sun never set on.
Right.
Well, where did they get the wealth from to do that? Where did they get the economy to support that type of empire? And the thing is, you notice whenever America broke away from England, hey, this ceased to be an empire. Slowly it disintegrated. So that's my point. And with Wm. Washington Brown, I sent you the number of businesses that he was able to create. And the thing is, he used social capital. And the thing is, if you look at what's this guy's name? That's one of the richest people in the world out in Nebraska. Shit. I can't think of his name, but...
Are you talking about white dude or black?
White guy. He's one of the richest guys. He's an investor.
I think I know who you're talking about. Name's right on the tip of my tongue now.
Yeah. But anyway, if you look at what Wm. Washington Brown did, what he did was he used insurance and he used banking to finance all of his other enterprises. And that's what this guy is doing today. And back in the day, what he did was corporations didn't operate back then like they do today, but he bought all of that forward because he was the first one to come up with a conglomerate of enterprises. If you look at the thing that I sent you yesterday, he invested in real estate, he invested in finance, he invested in insurance, he invested in medicine, all of those things that he was able to control at one time before he died. And like I told you before, I know a whole lot of people hate Al Sharpton because, you know, we are a white man's creation. And whatever white folk hate, we hate. But the thing is, you can't deny that he, before social media, he was able to gather enough people around his cause to go in and make sure that, hey, I bring attention to it, and he gets results. And look, when he was running for president, I don't know if you're old enough to remember it or not.
I remember when he ran.
When he was debating, they couldn't touch him. They couldn't touch him. I mean, he was able to do what Donald Trump did as far as debates goes. They couldn't trap him, and they couldn't compete with him in those debates. And the thing is, he's able to bring in media, and he's able to sway public opinion with what he does it.
Well, that's true. He's got his own radio network.
Yeah, when you hate him or love him, I mean, the thing is, the man brings results. And look, I don't agree with a whole lot of his policies, but you got to give the devil his dues. Now, with this thing about reparations, I marvel at black folk that have a problem with reparations and try to defend it. And I look at white folk that talk about reparations, and they don't have the vigor to try and defend reparations that a whole lot of black folks do. And I can't understand it. I'm like Warren, I can't understand it, but I'm from New Orleans. But here's the thing. when you look at slavery, who sanctioned it? Have you ever heard of the Royal Trading Company?
No, I haven't. But I know the
Royal Crown Trading Company.
The Pope was one of the people that sanctioned it, though.
Well, here's the thing. It's called the Royal African Company that was given a charter and a monopoly to trade slaves. The king gave them that monopoly to trade slaves. And they were responsible for shipping out most of the slaves from Africa over into this country. The king sanctioned it. And the thing is, where I come from in North Carolina, private enterprise profited from it. I mean, North Carolina was given land by the king. They were called the Seven Proprietors. And I think Sir Walter Raleigh belonged to a trading company in Virginia. The first colony that came over here was a private company that was sanctioned by the king. They had to get a charter from the king, just like you got to get a charter from the United States, I believe, to be a corporation, don't you?
Well, yeah.
What I'm saying is this. You can go and you can put out all kinds of arguments about who's responsible and who should pay in reparations and who shouldn't pay in all of this stuff. But the thing is, it happened on this soil. And the reason why I said that the American slave should be on Mount Rushmore, how many generations have profited and living off of the backs of slaves? Labor. I mean, you're talking about, yeah, you can go and say, well, it only happened 75 years because the country was only created legally for so many years. But look at the wealth that has served these generations for centuries. And look, I dare to say that the wealth that was created by slaves are probably gone for another 1,000 years. When you look at the Rockefellers, the Carnegies, and look at all of the Japanese billionaires and Chinese billionaires and all over the globe, all of this thing wouldn't happen without slavery. So now with this thing about, look, I told you yesterday that the only reason I'm for slavery is for reparations is because it brings up this conversation to let you know how dirty these savages are. As far as reparations is concerned, the money can't give descendants of slaves the wealth that they've created for all of these nations on the globe today. You can't do it. And the thing is, the only reason I bring it up because I want to make sure that my forefathers and mothers get credit for it. As far as slavery, as far as reparations is concerned, the hell with it. Because you know what? In the end, we're gonna dominate this society as far as economics goes. But the thing is, I want to make sure that people know whenever they sit down to the dinner table, whenever they use a credit card, or whenever they get in their car, where all of this came from. That's the only reason I support reparations. Now, you can go with these arguments of who got it and who don't.
I like the way you, matter of fact, framed it, at least in my mind, reframed it when you said the unknown slave?
Yeah, the unknown slave, yeah.
Yeah, I would say that alone is the best concept that I can think of for reparations. The unknown slave, because you're right, everything, you really can't deny it. No, the whole economy and including the British Empire.
Yeah, French.
Was
the
on
French.
The backs of the unknown slave.
Yeah. And look, all of Europe. All of Europe. And you can't deny that Europeans control the world economy. In fact, they tell you that. The world community, the G7. All of this is because of the power and the wealth that was accumulated here in the United States. And if you look at Rotterdam, I think, is it Rotterdam where all of the commerce and all of the shipping and everything gets out of
somewhere in Holland, either the Netherlands, Rotterdam, either Amsterdam, all that's in Holland.
Yeah, somewhere like that. All of that wouldn't exist without slavery. So when you hear people talk about, hey, you shouldn't do this and shouldn't do that, the hell with it. You know, just look at what you benefit from today. And the reason why I put Elijah McCoy in there is because, what, 85?
Oh, yeah,
85,
that's the person you had. Yeah, you had him in there yesterday.
The only reason you benefit and you're living comfortable today is because of what? Black inventors. So when I put that argument out there, I put it out there based on what is useful today and how we'll benefit. Now, as far as what you should get paid, they can never give us enough money or enough wealth to go in and repay back the suffering and the oppression that our forefathers was under. They'd never be able to do that. And when people argue against it, you know, I have a problem with them because they don't appreciate what they're benefiting from based on the suffering of my forefathers.
Now, you know, with the, and I love the concept, the unknown slave, because the way I'm looking at it, you can take the Mount Rushmore that we have right now and take your pick out of, you got what, Jefferson, Washington, Teddy Roosevelt, and Abraham Lincoln. Pick any one of those, take them off, and then put up the unknown slave.
Yeah.
Because we're not talking about, and I'm talking about Mount Rushmore. I ain't talking about a black Mount Rushmore. I'm talking about that concept alone, the unknown slave, all of them are linked to, they couldn't have been who they are without that unknown slave.
Yeah. And I'm going to end on this because I want to make myself clear. I'll get that later. This thing about the Republican Party was created to fight against slavery. There's a conversation that needs to be had on that. And the thing is, with that being the case, it's too extensive to go into today. But the Republican Party had nothing to do with trying to free the slaves, nor the Democratic Party, any other party in this country.
Okay, yeah, well, we're in it right now anyway. But tomorrow, the topic of tomorrow is the unknown slave, because the unknown slave has not been given its just due. On that note, thanks, Beasley. Thanks, Warren. Everybody have a good day.